Welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. Joining us this week on the ABCA podcast is former Ohio Dominican Athletic Director and Head Coach Paul Page. Coach Page is in this year's ATEC ABCA Hall of Fame class. In 29 seasons with Ohio Dominican, Coach Page won over 1,000 games. He's in the top 15 for career wins in NAIA. He started his coaching career with two legends in Mississippi State's Ron Polk and Marietta's Don Shaley. He coached two national championship teams at Marietta and led Ohio Dominican to 6 NAIA World Series appearances. In his time at Ohio Dominican, Coach Page produced 39 All-Americans and 20 academic All-Americans. This episode is all about work ethic, discipline, and accountability. We discuss the sacrifices along the way, player management, and his work now with coaches for coaches. Let's welcome Paul Page to the podcast. Here with Paul Page, 29 seasons as head coach at Ohio Dominican, over 1,000 wins, 2 national championships as an assistant at Marietta, and 6 World Series appearances as head coach at Ohio Dominican, and now ABCA Hall of Famer. So, Paul, thanks for jumping on with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, what does it mean going into the Hall of Fame for you?
Well, it's it provides an opportunity to reflect more than anything else, and I certainly know that this honor is not an individual honor. It's an honor that's going to be shared by a lot of people that made a lot of sacrifices and did a lot of the hard work and spent time and energy and effort to make good things happen, both at Ohio Dominican, at Marietta, even at Mississippi State.
I think that's probably my favorite part of the convention is watching not the guys going in or the girls going in. It's the people that are there to watch the people go in. It's amazing the amount of joy when people are walking into that Hall of Fame banquet room, how much joy people have going into that room.
Oh, absolutely. It's their honor as well, because they're the ones who put the hard work in and they don't get the recognition. You know, it's a little difficult to accept an award that's an individual award when you know in your heart it wasn't your award, it was their award as well as mine.
I mean, who are the biggest people that stick out to you that helped you along the way?
Well, honestly, I don't know that anybody was more fortunate than I was to work with two of the greatest coaches, both Hall of Famers. Ron Polk at Mississippi State, obviously. I think he's still the winningest coach in SEC baseball history. 2 years at Mississippi State with Coach Polk, and then 7 years as an assistant with Don Shaley at Division III Marietta, who is the winningest Division III coach in history. I still believe that's true as well. So who could have been more fortunate? Who could have been luckier than I was to be around those type of coaches that taught me more than the game? It taught me about the value of how you handle young men and what you can do in helping their growth.
How do you get from Muskegon College to Mississippi State?
That's a great question. The honest answer at that point in time, Muskegon College baseball program was less than stellar. Let's put it that way. And I knew after having played there 4 years, I loved the game. First of all, I loved the game. And I felt like I could learn. And I did have some instincts for the game, I felt like. And so I said, but if I want to coach, I want to be around the best people and learn the game from the inside out as much as I possibly could. So I just sat down at that point in time and sent a bunch of letters out to the most successful Division I coaches in the country. And Coach Polk answered that letter, and that got me in touch. And he was one of very few that did, but that's the kind of person he is. And so I ended up with him at Mississippi State, and it was quite an experience, as you can imagine. For me, throwing batting practice in front of 5,000 people before an Ole Miss game was quite an experience for me, and it was a great 2 years I spent there.
What years were you there at Mississippi State?
It was 76 and 77. His first 2 years there.
So, what were the things that stuck out? We all have that path along the way, coaching wise. You know, as soon as you show up at Mississippi State, what are the things that stuck out that, okay, they're doing things a little bit different here than maybe some other places were doing it?
Well, first of all, the one characteristic of both Coach Shiley and Coach Polk is their work ethic was incredible, off the charts incredible. And I was surprised by the number of hours they put in. I learned from that as well. The organization, the structure, the discipline, and setting of expectations all were a little bit different than what I was used to when I played, and I think probably different than most organizations at that point in time in those years.
With both those guys, how are they laying expectations out for the team?
Well, they were different in how they did it. Coach Polk, he was a little more laid back, I guess, in a different sort of way than what Coach Shiley was. But I think they both had an enormous amount of belief in their system and what they taught and how they taught it. And they stayed true to what they believed, whether it was their hitting philosophy or their pitching philosophy or whatever it may be. And they had ultimate confidence that those things would work if the players would buy in. And there was a different level of a different kind of demand at each institution about how that would come about.
So how do you get from Mississippi State to Marietta then?
Well, I was from Parkersburg, West Virginia, and Williamstown, actually, which is right across the river from Marietta. So I went home after I had gotten my degree at Mississippi State. I interviewed for a couple of jobs. It didn't work out. And it just so happened that at that point in time, Marietta was looking for an assistant coach. It was good fortune. It was great fate for me that Coach Shiley was looking, and I was ready, willing, and able. And my father actually owned a business there, and I could work at the business and still do the baseball coaching stuff. And Coach Shiley was very demanding, and the number of hours that I put in as what they called a part-time assistant coach was only part-time in name only. It was not truly a part-time position, but it was a great experience for me for 7 years.
I did the same thing at JMU. It was part-time pay, full-time hours, but I would go back and do it all over again. Talk about those decisions. I think they affect your path is going to successful programs. If you get to a successful place, that's going to allow you to get another job much easier if the program that you're in is having success.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was the AD at Ohio Dominican for 17 or 18 years. And when I hired coaches, I wanted coaches that came from successful programs. Knowing how to win is something that a lot of people don't understand, that it's important to ongoing success.
How do you develop that?
Well, I think you carry on the things that they were doing. You know, you're demanding of the players. You have high expectations for them. You believe in your program, you believe in what you teach, and you do it on a consistent basis day in and day out every year. And players, after a point in time, realize, hey, if I do this, we're going to have team success. If I do this, we're going to have some individual honors as well. And guys can see the guy, you get different levels of buy-in from different players at points in time. And it's significant that the people that didn't buy in as much didn't have the same level of success. So you find those players, you trust in them, you teach them, and then the results are what they are.
How were you handling accountability issues with your players?
We didn't make exceptions. Everybody became accountable for each other. It's a team. Baseball is a team game with individual battles. And if you're not going to do your part as a player, then the team's not going to have success. So everybody, you know, the expectation that you're going to go to class, that you're going to do the job, that there's going to be some community service, that you're going to follow the rules and regulations. And not that there weren't guys that stepped over the bounds, that there were, but they were handled with swiftly and fairly. And I think that was important as well. You know, and you're dealing with guys that are 18 to 22 years old, and down the line, they're going to make some mistakes. And the fairness part of it is important to the success of the ball club as well.
There's a great story about the USA rowing team. Their motto was, "Will it make the boat faster?" So that boiled down to their decision making on their daily decisions. Sleep, nutrition was
right.
that was the question they always asked themselves: is, will this make the boat faster?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I mean, is that really the difference between a successful team and an unsuccessful team? Is the sacrifices they're willing to make?
Well, it's certainly part of it. We had a saying that my guys probably got tired of hearing, saying that everything counts. It's not just on the field. It's not just in the classroom. We talked about God, family, academics, athletics, and social life, and how you have to have those in that order and keep them in that order. And there's time for all of them, but you have to do it in the correct fashion. Success comes also because you have to have good players. You know, you can do all those things and not have good players, you're not going to be very good. And there were years I found that out. There's no question about it. You have to have quality players and guys that are willing to grow and get better. And when you're at a place like a High Dominican, you're not going to go get, obviously, the greatest players, five-star. You have to get guys that you see talent in, have potential, and then help them grow so they become All-Americans or All-Conference-type players. And we had our fair share of those guys as well.
You had 10 seasons of 40-plus wins, so you're used to success. But those seasons that you weren't having success, how are you handling those teams? You know, where you get in the middle of the season, maybe it's not that it's a disappointing year because every year is a journey, but how are you handling those teams to try to get the most out of those teams?
Well, I think you have to keep your eyes forward, look forward, and say, we got to grow from this. We've got to get better. And who's rowing the boat with us and who's not rowing the boat with us? And those are the decisions you have to make in terms of the challenges that you have from year to year. And fortunately, we had a number of really good years. We had some years that weren't so good, but we try to keep looking forward all the time.
How were you handling, you get to the end of the year and you know someone's not in the boat with you? How are you handling those situations with players?
We would certainly have individual one-on-one conversations, explain to them the value of a team and that the team is the most important thing. And if you're not willing to be a part of that, then we're going to have to make a difficult decision.
Yeah, those were tough conversations with kids.
Absolutely.
Because some just don't know. And, you know, you just hope that at some point the light either turns on for them with you or hopefully turns on for them when they're with a different program or doing what
exactly.
They're doing.
Exactly.
Hey, what do you wish you would have known coming from an assistant to going and taking over the head job? What would you have wish you would have known?
Well, I honestly think I was very well prepared. I mean, spending 9 years with those two guys, I had a pretty good idea. I knew what the work demand was. I knew I had a pretty good eye for what it took to run a successful program. I felt really prepared. I don't think there were any major surprises in that regard. I think I was ready for that. And, you learn as you go. You know, that I wasn't nearly as good a coach that first year as I was maybe 3 or 4 years later, but it took some time to find out what a High Dominican was about, what their values were, how you recruited players to that program. It was a different environment than the young men we were recruiting at Marietta. It was certainly a different environment than the young men we recruited at Mississippi State. So you had to find out what the niche for that university was and recruit accordingly.
What were the differences? I mean, if you're, you know, your kids that were successful at Ohio Dominican, what were the characteristics of those kids?
Well, most of the kids in Ohio Dominican were first generation college kids. So they didn't have the same background that the kids at Marietta had. Most of them were a little bit more academically challenged. Ohio Dominican was a great institution that looked after the people that they were recruiting. They had great support staff for people academically. We had a tremendous ESL program, English as a second language program, that we could bring in people that were Spanish speakers and they could transfer into the regular classroom in a year and a half and do phenomenally well. So that was a totally different dynamic than I had ever worked with before, but it was good for our baseball program. And they're kids that were a little bit more humble in a lot of different ways. So it was working with those kind of young men, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And the benefit today is I look back and see the success that they had. Some of those kids were not great high school students, but those kids today, you know, 35 years later, are successful in what they're doing. And it feels so good to know that a lot of those guys are giving me some credit for that, which is, I'm not sure it's accurate, but they do. And those days when you're retired and you're wondering what this is all about, and you get a phone call saying, "Hey coach, thanks for what you did." Those are meaningful days for me.
That was the most gratifying piece for me is recruiting kids that you knew it was going to be a struggle for, but end up getting their degree. That was the most satisfying piece for me.
Oh yeah. Oh, when that light clicks on and they become a good student and a student that really cares about learning. Wow. That's better than anything happened on a baseball field. It really is.
Well, let's be honest. High school is boring. I mean, and it is, you know, you're stuck there. And some of those kids that aren't great students in high school, they just haven't found what they're passionate about. And hopefully they do find that in college, you know, and once they do find it, the sky's the limit for those kids.
Yeah. Those guys are very grateful. They're more grateful than other people are, because they realize, boy, I needed some help, and they got it, and they're appreciative of that.
How are you handling the language barrier with your Spanish speaking players?
Well, I didn't speak Spanish and I'm not sure I wanted to know everything they were saying anyway. But you know, what was interesting, there were coaches that would come to me and say, "How do you handle those young men from Puerto Rico? Aren't they troublemakers?" And I'm saying, I've got young men from Columbus that are as many, and the ratio is the same. You know, you always use the 80-20 rule. You get 80% of the people are doing the right thing and 20% are probably doing something different. It was the same. And the thing about the young men from Puerto Rico is they love to play baseball. Now, they dearly love to play baseball. And so it made it easy because that's what we were doing. We worked hard at it, and they appreciated it. Some of those guys did very well, and they are still doing well.
And there's some lack of entitlement. I mean, a kid that's grown up, maybe really tough upbringing, not of their own doing, they're going to be a little bit more appreciative of the things that you have that maybe someone that's a little more entitled or been given a little bit more. They're not going to be as appreciative of what you have.
That's exactly true. Yeah, and all those young men from Puerto Rico came from difficult situations. And they were in an environment where there was structure and discipline that really, I think, helped them a lot. And to this day, they're appreciative.
How were you getting those kids from Puerto Rico? I mean, were you going down there? Were you relying on handlers down there? How were you getting your kids from Puerto Rico?
Well, when I got to Ohio Dominican, they had a number of Puerto Rican players. And the ESL program was a big part of the campus. And when I interviewed the president of the university, Sister Mary Andrew Matesic, told me that she wanted me to continue to recruit Puerto Rican players. And I said, okay. I didn't speak Spanish. I didn't have any contacts in Puerto Rico. And at the same time, the college hired a gentleman by the name of Julio Morales from Puerto Rico. And he became the Puerto Rican recruiter. And he and I became dear friends. And we went to Puerto Rico a number of times. We actually went to Puerto Rico. Our team went down and played in 1990, my second or third year. and played the Puerto Rican national team and made some contacts and had a quite an experience down there. And it was the year that they had the Golden Globe games in Cuba. And we played the national team, Puerto Rican national team, to play that and had two really good ball games with them. So that was my first experience down there. And it was a learning experience. We had to find the right people down there. The first group of young men we brought in struggled academically. They weren't academically attuned to what needed to happen. And we finally figured out where the references were, the people that we needed to talk to, and brought in guys that were what we needed and that valued the education that they needed to do to have success. So it was quite a process, and it was good for our program. It was good for the university.
Well, because the faith lines up there too, from Puerto Rican standpoint, coming to Ohio Dominican, correct?
Yes, absolutely, no question about that.
Because that's a huge part of the culture down there is you know, the Catholic piece, the religious piece.
Yeah, it was a great fit. And unfortunately, the university in 2002 or 2003 did away with the ESL program, and we were no longer able to recruit the Puerto Rican people because we weren't going to do them any favors. You know, and when we went down there, the thing that you discovered was a lot of those young men who were baseball talent were going to junior colleges. Well, when they got done with 2 years of junior colleges, they had no avenue to get into a four-year school because of the curriculum that they were given. And they still couldn't speak English. So Ohio Dominican was a great place for them at that point in time because of the ESL.
I've had quite a few inductees here recently that did the dual athletic director and head coach role. Do we miss that in college athletics now? We don't have as many ADs that were coaches. Are we missing that in college athletics right now?
I think there's a huge value to having coached your own club and seeing the challenges that presents. I mean, if you've not done it, when somebody comes up and says, I need this or that, anybody can say that. If you've lived it, and we lived it, High Dominican, when I was the AD, I went into a very challenging situation. We only had six sports. We only had baseball was the only one that really had any level of success. And our basketball program struggled. And it took a long time to get those turned around. It took 4 or 5 years to get those turned around. And that was a greater challenge for me than the baseball part of it was, because you're taking basketball teams that win one or two games. They're like 2-26 or 1-29. It's harder to turn a bad program around than it is to build a good one. That's more difficult to have one that's just really struggling because everybody sees it as being something that's a negative.
Hey, what got those programs turned around?
Well, I convinced the administration that we need to put some more resources into them, both in a lot of ways. And then we were able to hire, we were building a new facility, which helped. And we were able to hire people that were bringing discipline and structure to the programs, which was desperately required and needed. It's required in any successful program, but it is really required in programs that are real facing challenges that they were facing. And guys, the people that worked their fans off to make it happen for them. And, you know, I was proud. Our teams finally ended up going to some NAIA national tournaments, as basketball teams did. We grew the program from the six. I think we had 10 or 12 when I was finished up as the AD. So there's some pride I have in that as well.
Do you have any fundraising tips?
We worked so many different fundraising events. It was unbelievable. We sold candy bars. We worked Halloween nights. I mean, for weeks on end, we worked Ohio State football games. It was non-ending. We had to raise to go to Florida. We had to raise on our own every penny out. But now it became a $25,000-$30,000 trip when you're down there a week. And obviously, a lot of that's changed. A lot of teams aren't going to Florida anymore. But no, there were a lot of fun. There was a lot of fundraising being done. Yes,
the hit-a-thon. That's playing for my dad at Evansville. That was our big one. Yeah. But you know, everybody got to go to spring training or spring break because of it.
Yeah.
You know, that was part of the deal. If you raised enough money, you could go. But I, that was feel like what I did all fall was making hit-a-thon calls because he would give the heavy hitters to me, so I would it feel like I was making 20 calls. Yeah. But that helped me later on. You know, I know players don't always like doing that, but I think about the amount of life skills I developed in college by making those phone calls and asking sure. people for money. And I feel like it helped the alumni stay connected to the program too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Doing something that makes you feel uncomfortable is not always a bad thing.
That's a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, so those days you got to go to Ohio State for football games, lay that schedule out. Cause I there's a lot of programs that do that. But lay that schedule out so people that don't have a feel for what that actually entails for your guys, what that schedule is like.
Well, first of all, you have to know that I am not an Ohio State football fan. So that made it a good bit more challenging for me. But you know, it's a 6 o'clock a.m. call. Depends on the game time, the 6 a.m. call. And then your work. We did security detail, and guys had to wear their yellow vest and be around the stadium, watch for problems. And it was often a 10 or 12 hour day. I mean, it just was all day. And it was good. And it got to the point where I would offer them an out if they wanted to pay the money that they would all otherwise make. And then I'm not sure that was a good thing. Because a lot of the mommies didn't want their boy to do the Ohio State games. It was too hard for them, you know. So, but we had our fair share of doing that as well.
Hey, what are some things that you kept over the years, coaching wise? You know, you talked about with Coach Polk and Coach Shally just kind of staying true to themselves. So, what are some things that you kept over the years coaching?
Well, you know, I think the guys that for the most part, and there are obviously exceptions, understood that I cared for them and I loved them. And more than anything, that stood steadfast through the years. And people see the way that they were handled. Some people didn't understand what love was. Love isn't just saying yes all the time. Yes is saying no in hard times and making difficult decisions. You try to play your best players and you try to reward your hardest workers. Those aren't always one and the same. And so but if the old saying is they don't know how much you know until you know they know how much you love them. And that's obviously true. And the relationships that were built at a high Dominican in Marietta, I stay close to much of those guys from Marietta. Are still here today because I think the way they were treated when they were at those two institutions, and they knew that I cared, and not that I cared only, but that the people around me cared for them too. We had an assistant coach in our program that passed away 3 or 4 years ago by the name of Ron Casserly that was as good for me as he possibly could be. And he's a Columbus police officer, and his intuition was incredible, and his care for the players was incredible. And in a way, he was one of the most valuable people. And he wasn't what I would call a great baseball guy, but he was his intuition and his care did as much for our program as somebody that was a phenomenal baseball person. And he provided me with the one thing that I never had a great deal of, and that was confidence. I never had a great deal of confidence, and he helped me through those difficult. That was the most difficult time when having been around the two guys I were, I don't think either one of them would say that they had a level of issue with confidence, Coach Shally or Coach Polk. And I did. But Ron Casserly helped me through that because he believed in what we were doing. So he became an important part of our program. And guys still talk about him today. So it's a good thing.
For somebody that's not confident, how do you develop that confidence?
Well, it helps when you win.
Yes.
But all the work that you put in is rewarded by success. And it got to the point where I think I developed a level of confidence, but I don't think I was ever quite at the level that maybe I could have been or should have been. But when you see guys get better, when you see doing what you're asking them to do, when you see guys become great because they're working on the things that you're asking them to work on, you see guys become professional baseball players that didn't have the they had the tools, obviously, but they didn't have the knowledge or they didn't have the work ethic. That gives you a level of success or a confidence maybe otherwise I wouldn't have had.
But let me ask you this. Is it better to be underconfident or overconfident?
The days that you win, it's better to be underconfident. The days you lose, you better be overconfident. You have to believe in what you're doing. And you can't, you know, all this with the success that we had, you know, should I make it? And baseball's you know, this baseball's changed dramatically in the last 8 or 10 years. And coaching's become more difficult because of it. You know, there's a lot of guys were searching for answers on the internet. And if you believe in something, regardless of how ridiculous it is, you can find it on the internet and somebody's going to tell you it's the right thing.
It's confirmation bias.
Yeah.
It's not just baseball. It's life now. It's society. Yeah. You know, you can find anything to confirm your belief on the internet, whether it's right or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had a player late in my career and I guess I gathered up enough confidence to tell him this. He had a couple of really bad falls and he had some tools. I mean, he had good hands and had left-handed hitter, had some pop, but he hit like 220 in our fall and he thinks he's going to come in and start for us. And I said, well, what would make me think that you ought to start for us? I said, you're not listening to what I tell you. I said, let me ask you, who is your hitting coach? And he told me this guy. I said, now what kind of success has he had? I said, has he been to 10 World Series? No. Has he coached a team that's led the nation in hitting? No. Well, I've done those things. Why would you think he might be a better resource for you than I am? And he didn't have an answer for that. And he did start listening a little bit better, but he would still fluctuate back and forth, you know, and it was a tough deal. You'd watch him fail and you're going, you shouldn't be failing. You're too good to fail.
If your success is predicated on wins and losses, then you probably need to pay attention to someone that is part of their job is the wins and losses. Yeah. And then backtrack to people that don't have skin in the game for wins and losses. But we would tell our players all the time, I'm like, it's fine. There's so much information out there and there's a lot of great information, but do some digging on the person's bio. And if they get paid for wins and losses, then go ahead and take some credence to what they're saying and then filter back from there. There's some great swing coaches out there. There's some great pitching trainers out there. But at the end of the day, they're not getting fired if their players don't have success or not.
Exactly. I wish you could have told that young man what you just told me.
We dealt with it. You know, that was 19 was my last spring. And social media, there's some great things with it, but it's exactly what you're talking about. There's so much information out there, so you really have to take it with a grain of salt. If that person's telling you something and that player's success, wins and losses don't affect, and I think differently at times, and you know, I think things would change if a facility owner got butts in the seats, whether their teams, the kids that they're working with, whether that team had success or not, there might be some change in how instruction is laid out.
Exactly. Well, and if you're a hitting instructor, your job and that's your employment. That's how you're getting paid. You want that young man to come back. So what are you going to say? Oh, you look really good. It's not your fault if you fail. That's got to be your coach's fault, you know? That makes it a little more challenging as well.
Well, to get the desired result in a game, a training session in the cage is going to look extremely ugly because there needs to be failure in the cage in order for it to translate. And that's pitching and hitting both. If you want it to translate onto the field for success, it's going to be ugly. So in a 45 to 60 minute training session in the cage, if that player's getting it handed to them in that training session, how likely are they to come back? Now, if they come back, you got a great kid there and a great set of parents, but that's not always the case.
That's exactly right. It was funny. I coached a 15-year-old team last summer here in Hurricane, West Virginia. And I'd never coached 15-year-olds before. And it was both very enjoyable and extremely frustrating. And you'd go in, they have great facilities. They've got a nice batting building. And I go in and every ball was just, they were just trying to see how hard they could hit it. And the ball's in the air, and they're you know, they're 5'8", 135 pounds. And so I asked one of them, I said, "Do you guys ever try to hit breaking balls?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I tried that one day." He said, "I put that," he said, "I got," he said, I didn't do it after that." He said, I couldn't hit it. I couldn't hit it. So I didn't, well, maybe in a game you may have to hit that thing, you know, but he didn't want to fail. He didn't want to work at it through failure. He wanted to work at it and have success. Well, you're not going to do that. It's just not going to happen. And so as a result, the whole summer, he never hit a breaking ball. He was right. He never got one.
Don't sell the cows yet, Mom. They're throwing breaking balls.
Yeah.
What are some things that you changed over the years?
Oh, well, I think the one thing that comes to mind, I think I became a little bit more tolerant, which maybe was a bad thing. I don't know whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. I probably became more tolerant. I became less emotional. That may have been a bad thing too. But it has to do with getting older and not being totally feeling good all the time. And then the other thing was when the change in the bats made us do some changing too. When those bats were at their peak, I was watching guys that couldn't hit a lick, hitting the ball 350 feet over the left field fence. I'm thinking, we got to make an adjustment here, because it doesn't make any difference how good or bad you are. You can hit the ball out of the ballpark and have success. So we did some things different when the bats became so explosive.
How are you helping your players that spring? You know, for people that didn't have to go through that, that was right in the middle of us being at Iowa, and it was a tough spring. That first spring with the bat changes was a really hard spring for our players. How were you handling the bat change with your players?
Well, we didn't allow them to give any excuses. You know, first of all, you've got to learn to barrel the ball. That's what hitting's about. And the fact that last year you could hit it off the handle and hit it 350 feet, or hit it off the end and hit it 360 feet, that's not what this is about. Let's see how we can get the point where we're barreling the ball on a consistent basis. And there's no excuses. I mean, you got to learn to do it. You got to learn to do it. If you don't learn to do it, we're going to fail. And that's not an option in this situation.
And they're so much better now. The hard part for me, and I was a hitting guy back then, the hard part for me is there was no feel for the sweet spot. You couldn't tell, you know, when they went from the BSR to the BB core, even if you squared the ball up, you couldn't tell like you could with the old bats or even with a wood bat. And so that was the biggest adjustment for me with our guys is you couldn't tell if you got it or not. There was zero instant feedback with the ball coming off your bat when they switched.
Yeah. Yeah. They all thought they were pretty good.
Quick break for another one of our sponsors, Mark Pro. That is MARC Pro. Personally, I used it as a coach for my ragged out BP arm and legs after a tough workout. We saw huge benefits with our pitchers and position players in decreased soreness and recovery time. It's an amazing machine that speeds up the recovery process by getting blood flow back to the areas that need it. It's durable and cost effective. The Mark Pro needs to be a tool in your peak performance toolkit. I can't recommend it enough. Hit me up if you have any questions. Order now on markpro.com and use the promo code ABCA to get 10% off. Now back to the podcast. What are some other characteristics of your favorite players over the years?
The way our program was, Ryan, hard work was what set us apart. Guys that guys that knew how to work, you know, and you can go in a batting cage and spend 8 hours and not get a bit better. You can go in and throw bullpen after bullpen and not get a bit better. You've got to do it with a purpose. Our program was about those guys understanding the value of hard work, but working smart and working for a purpose and working for the team, not working to see how many home runs you could hit or how I can get backspin on the ball. No, we're not. No, let's see what we can do and get the ball in play and play the game the way I was taught through Coach Polk and Coach Shiley and seeing the success that we've had. And guys bought into that. Some of our clubs really bought into it, and that was what made them special. Those guys, and what's funny, the guys that were really good at that are really successful when they left. whether regardless of what occupation, regardless of what they did, incredibly successful because they understood the value of hard work and working smart. And we've got guys that are attorneys today. We got guys that are accountants today. And you would know that when based on their work ethic. And that comes from having great parents too. You know, you can find young men that are great young men that don't have great parents, but you can almost always find great young men who have great parents. Yeah. So, you know, you give those their moms and dads and the people that love them first credit for having that kind of work ethic and understanding how this is supposed to happen.
Yeah, and you talked about players that work hard, and that makes your job much easier with writing a lineup when you have players that work hard but are also talented. How are you handling that where you have guys that are battling for positions where maybe you have a kid that's working his tail off, but he's not as good as the guy that he's battling with? How are you battling? How are you dealing with that when maybe you've got a player that's more talented than the other one, even though he's not working as hard as the other kid?
Yeah, well, you have to be honest with kids, and they understand that, you know. I had a story. This was early in my career. We had a young man that we had a JV program, and our left fielder, who was a really good player, got hurt. And we ended up putting our DH into left field. Our DH was hitting 440, and he was a very adequate left fielder. Well, one young man came in to see me. He said, "I think I should be playing left field." And I said, "Well, you're playing JV and you're hitting like 230 or 240. And I said, "You have yet to hit a cutoff, man." I said, "He hasn't missed one." I said, "Maybe if you started hitting cutoff men." I said, "The other day you missed the cutoff men, batter runner got to second base. I maybe consider playing you defensively, but you can't do that." I said, "You have to do the right thing. Are you physically as gifted? Probably, but you don't work as hard." And so you be honest with them. And for those guys that understand, You do what you can. You still love them, take care of them, and do the best you can by them.
I want to back up now. With your 15U team that you're coaching, were you doing most of the same things with that group that you were doing with your college teams?
I didn't know what to do with them. I didn't know. They were so clueless. And they're in a good high school program, but they haven't gotten through the program yet where they didn't understand, relays, cutoffs and relays. So we started with that sort of stuff, just basic team stuff. And, I felt really good about myself and I never got mad. I tried to stay even keel, but yeah, I mean, that cutoff thing was a hard thing for them, and understanding base running and how base running works and what the opportunities are. So it was a slow teach. It was a very slow teach. And I think we did it for about 6 weeks, and they got better. I really liked the practices because you could see them grow in practices, but the translation from a practice to a game was not what I would have hoped it would have been. But you don't practice every day. You're not with them all the time. The most frustrating part was the hitting part, because this was probably the first summer that they saw somebody that actually could throw a breaking ball that actually broke. And they just had no idea. And it didn't have to break very much because they weren't going to hit it. And if I had to do it over again, if I could rewind the clock and do it over again, I'd probably start, let's talk about hitting a little bit more and how you go about this instead of the team stuff. And I don't know which was right or which was wrong. You don't have enough time to teach everything, with that kind of situation.
But what were the team cuts and relay stuff that you were doing with them?
Oh, it would be tandem relays. Even the basic stuff, single to right field, runner at second base, and who's the cutoff, and where's the pitcher supposed to be, and that kind of basic stuff. Tandem relays, they were an interesting watch, and trying to teach them and where to throw the ball and how the relay man's supposed to catch it and where he's supposed to be and all the stuff that you teach and teach and teach, and they didn't value any of that sort of stuff. One of the interesting things is we had three guys playing shortstop. They thought they could run the ball over to first base faster than they could throw it. They field it, take about 12 steps to first base. And the guy ultimately beat him by a step. And we tried to work on that. It was hilarious to try to get them to understand, catch it and throw it, because now these guys can run a little bit better. So
get the stopwatch out.
Yeah.
Hey, with your college guys, how are you helping them? How are you developing breaking ball hitters in college?
Well, we had a lot of different drills. You know, you teach them to wait on the ball and get it deep and let it travel and that sort of stuff. You know, we do tee work with them. We do what we call a three ball drill on the outside third of the plate to get them to wait on the ball. There's a lot of different things you can do with the breaking ball. And ultimately, they didn't like hitting the breaking ball off the pitching machine either, but we didn't give them a choice. You know, you're going to learn to do this and you're going to fail, and it's okay. It's okay. So we did a lot of different stuff.
Keep your hands back. Had some really ugly hitters that could keep their hands back and looked awful lower half wise, but still barreled the ball up because they could keep their hands back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a fail forward moment? Do you have something you thought was going to sidetrack you, but looking back now was one of the best things that happened to you?
There were people that told me I wasn't good enough to do this. There were people that told me I wasn't good enough to do this and I wouldn't have success.
How were those conversations? I mean, because I think we all, you're going to have people that doubt you along the way. Like, hey, I'm interested in college coaching or I'm interested in this position. Like, how were those conversations
I'm interested in being a college baseball coach and you're not, you know, I think because I came from a small school, we didn't have any teaching level. So that person dismissed my passion and my ability, my willingness to work, because they didn't give me a chance and they didn't understand. And that was, and that maybe helped me along the way. You know, you look back at it and say, okay, all right. Certainly this award and the success we had, is the best revenge for that.
You can't discount. It's just like players. You can't discount someone's work ethic. If they're going to work, they're at least going to exceed their ceiling, you know, and the limitations that maybe are put on people. If someone is willing to sacrifice and work, they're going to exceed those expectations. And you don't really know what's inside somebody's chest until they start working through it. And, you know, if everybody worked as hard as they could, you'd see a lot more successful people out there. Yeah, but that's what gets people.
Well, and I think being a willing listener too, a willing listener is almost as important. You have to be willing to, you have to work hard, but you have to listen and you have to see and be able to evaluate. Well, what is success? How does Coach Polk win all these games? And I'll tell you, my first year at Mississippi State, I think we were 27-19. Honestly, we didn't have a player. His program, his the way he went about things, allowed us to have a certain level of success that I was stunned. And I certainly am more stunned today when I look back on what the SEC has become as to what it was then. And there were great young men, but there wasn't a pro on that club. Now look at what they have now. So you have to go, how's this happen? Well, it's happening because he's working his fanny off. He's working smart. And
he changed college baseball. I mean, there's certain guys, him, Ron Frazier, Rod Dedeau, Skip Bertman, he changed college baseball.
Yeah. Yeah. And you may not know this, Ryan, but in a different sort of way, so did Coach Shalley at that level.
Yes.
I mean, he was putting teams on the field that were way, I mean, the guys that we won the national title with in 81, my Lord, it was unbelievable. There were four or five guys that, I mean, they were like five first team All-Americans. Well, how are you going to keep up with that? It made everybody else go, well, I better start working a little bit harder, you know? And so he changed it in his way as well. So, and there's no question Coach Polk did. I mean, he was going to dominate the SEC unless some people stood up and started doing something different.
Do you have any morning or evening routines that you like that you use to try to help you stay on top of your daily schedule?
Today or back when I was coaching?
Both. Both. Let's go coaching and then what are you doing now?
Well, we did a lot of practices at 6:15 in the morning when it was snowing outside. We had one facility we could go to. I lived about 20 minutes away from campus and driving on slick, snowy roads at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm getting up at 5:30. but it was, there was an innate value to that that I can't put my finger on. It really was. And then as an AD there, I would say for basketball games, there were nights I'd work, I mean, from 6 o'clock in the morning till I get home at 11 o'clock at night, you know, and so you're recruiting and doing that sort of stuff. So it was, there was a lot of long days. There were a lot of long days in there, but it was good too.
How are you handling the lack of sleep?
Oh, I don't require a lot of sleep.
I love it.
Yeah, I don't require a lot of sleep. Now, I hated getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning when it's snowing outside. I didn't like it at 5:30, I guess, but I hated that. I'm proud to this day, I never was 1 second late for any of those days. And when our players were late, I never gave them any benefit of the doubt either. They had to be there too. So, but it set a standard for them. They knew.
That was my worst fear as a coach, was players being late for early morning practices, because, you know, along the way you had to do it, and it was always not the same time every day. So I just worried for our players. They're out of their sleep routine, but, you know, you have to have some discipline to do that. So we spent a lot of time with our players talking about trying to set their schedules and prepare them a little bit for that. They're like, hey, you know, there's some days we're going to practice in the morning, and then there's some days we're going to be in the afternoon. So, like, how do you prep for that?
Right.
That was always my biggest fear as a coach. The guys were going to walk in late, because then you got to deal with it.
Yeah, well, our guys lived in a residence hall, which was a 5-minute walk from where we were working out. And so if somebody came late, everybody had to receive the results of that. And so there was some extra. You had to do that once every 3 or 4 years, where if somebody'd walk in late, they never, you know, for the next 3 years, they knew, I can't be late because everybody's going to run for it, or somebody's going to get punished. We're all going to get punished for it, whatever that might be. So it was about every 3 or 4 years, we had to remind everybody how this works.
Yep. That's peer mentoring too, relying on your teammates to pick each other up and get the phone tree.
You're responsible. Go knock on the door and get him up, get him out of bed.
Do you have a favorite ABCA convention story?
You know, I'm trying to think. My first one was in Atlanta, and I think it was, I can't remember. I'll tell you my favorite story. Now, Coach, my first year at Marietta, the convention was in Atlanta, and I drove my car, and Coach Shally was on the rules committee. So we drove to Atlanta, and from Marietta, Ohio, it's probably, I'm guessing it was an 8 or 9 hour drive. And so the convention's over on Saturday, but Coach Shally has to stay for Sunday. So and Coach Shally was is the worst snorer in the history of snoring. and I am rooming with him for 3 nights, and I haven't slept at all. There's no sleeping. I mean, it was unbelievable. So on Sunday, it starts snowing in Atlanta. And there was a huge winter storm from that started above Marietta and came clear down to Atlanta. I'm driving home in this winter storm, and we're going 30 and 40 miles an hour the whole way. Now, I haven't slept for 3 nights. He's in the seat next to me snoring like crazy. We get to Ripley, West Virginia, which is typically about an hour from Marietta, and he wakes up and he goes, do you want me to drive the rest of the way? And I said, hell no, I don't want you to drive the rest of the way. I've been driving for 13 hours. He's been sleeping the whole time. It was unbelievable. And we got in and my wife was crying. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have any way to stop. Sue, his wife was crying. Where have you guys been? We've been driving 35 miles an hour, and I'm listening to this guy snore for 14 hours. So that was the most memorable ABCA convention I went to because of that.
I spoke in 2012 on the main stage in Anaheim, and my roommate that weekend, Mike Neal Curley from Blackburn, is a tremendous snorer. So I did not get any sleep during that convention because of his snoring, but I made it through on Sunday by the skin of my teeth, having to speak on Sunday.
Oh yeah, that was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. So I learned. See, I learned from that. I didn't ride in the same car with you ever again. I'm not doing that anymore.
What are some final thoughts or anybody else you want to thank that haven't been able to thank?
Well, there's a lot of people, Ryan. I mean, certainly your players, but the guys that coached with me that we started, and you may not know this, I started a charity organization two or three years ago called Coaches for Coaches. And the Coaches for Coaches, my buddies in coaching, which are John Shalley and Brian Brewer and Mike Deegan, Chris Antonides, who replaced me at a High Dominican, Tim Meek, guys that are just great guys. Well, I was playing golf with those guys Shalley and Mead and Mike and Keith Veal, and I played golf my last 3 or 4 years that I was coaching, and then we've continued to do that, and we added Brewer, got to an 8, and then we have a big deal where we play for a bat, and Brewer's got the bat, and now we got to get it out of Brewer's hands. It's embarrassing that he has it, but we started this organization because small college baseball assistant coaches, grad assistant coaches, have no financial resources, or most of them have none. You know, and I always tell the story, my first year at Marietta, my salary was $1,000. We won the national title in 81, and I got a $100 raise. And that's not, it's probably a little better today, but it's not unusual. And all these guys went through similar situations, you know. So we started this organization, we've raised money, we have a golf outing, we've raised money. Those guys have become very important in my life, and they've been, and they were great friends before. And we were able to give a young man from Wilmington College $1,000. His name's Daniel McCarty. And Daniel McCarty is in a wheelchair. He has a bone disease, and he is an assistant coach there. And I went to see Dan and talk to him and presenting the check. And he's baseball savvy now. He knows the game. And he's helped Tony Notorio immensely. So we wanted to honor him, just say thanks for doing something that's truly extraordinary. So those guys, yes, obviously assistant coaches that gave and gave and gave. And you probably went through this as well. I because of that constant turnover, because you couldn't pay him, I had a guy by the name of Chris Wallace that was a great, should have been a pitching coach at a big time school. And he had 5 kids and he was making $15,000 a month getting benefits. And he couldn't continue to do that. And so those are the kind of people that are in my mind when we started this organization. It'll be good, and we try to make it grow.
Hey, where can people find Coaches for Coaches?
Well, we have a website, coachesforcoaches.com, and it's F-O-R-E, which puts the golf part into it. And we're trying to, obviously, the key to this is to get more sponsorships, and we need to get sponsorships from some big organizations.
Hey, when is that golf outing?
This year it was the second week of August. We're going to look at it, maybe move it to the first week of August.
Okay. Yeah. Cause stay with me on that. Cause I can always send stuff out for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great event. We raised, I think, $8,000, which is a good start for us. And hopefully we're going to have a committee get together here in a week or so and try to figure out the best way to move forward with this. But it's a good program. It's needed. And also, you know, the small college coaches, even the head coaches, don't make any money. You know, you look at it. So what if somebody has a significant financial, urgent financial need because a family member is in a car wreck or is sick or has a disability in some fashion? Let's be able to help them out too, because the financial discrepancy between what these guys are making and what the guys at the bigger schools are making is truly ridiculous and significant. And they're putting in the same amount of time, the same amount of work. And some of them are better coaches too, by the way. So it's something that I think we, and all these guys are on board with that. And, but there's a bunch of people. I know I've been asked to make a list and send to you guys about names that will go up on that board. The guy that hired me, Jim Sagona, Julio Morales, who we talked about earlier, that were big parts of our success. Sister Mary Andrew Matesik, who was our president, who allowed us to do some of the things we were able to do, and build a university that was very attractive to me because it was about others. It was the mission of the university was very close to my beliefs, and it worked really well for me. So she was significant in my ability to have whatever success we had. So yeah, there's a number of people, and I'm probably leaving people out. You know, certainly my family, my wife, and you know this, the sacrifices that she's made, my son who played for me has made, and the love that they have for what we have done and have been doing. She's phenomenal. You know, she is phenomenal. And thank God she had a great job all those years so that I can retire and enjoy life right now. But my brother, and I mean, there's a number of people that are part of the success, a big part of the success that we had and allowed this to happen. And I guess ultimately, I am thrilled for them because it makes me sit back and say, hey, they did the job too. They did the job. And the players, we had great young men in our program. I mean, great young men. And I was blessed. You know, and a lot of it's some hard work and some of it's knowing some stuff and some of it's just being lucky and being at the right place at the right time.
And that was part of the reason why I wanted to do these, because we did them last year out of necessity with COVID, with the inductees, just to give them an opportunity to tell their stories. But you know, you get 5 minutes up there, so hopefully this takes a little bit of the load off of guys getting 5 minutes at the Hall of Fame banquet. You guys have such great stories. It's just amazing to me all the sacrifices that successful coaches have to make in the baseball world just to make it work. It's amazing.
Yeah. But you love the game. You love the game, but you love the players. You know, the best days are when we had a deal, Ryan, about a month ago that Jonathan Sanchez, who played for me and pitched in the big leagues and pitched a no-hitter, called me back in February. He said, Coach, I want to, and he's living in Puerto Rico. He goes, I want to come back to Columbus. I want to pitch at a high Dominican's field again. And I want you to coach me one more time. Okay. I'll certainly be there. And it was a wonderful weekend. And Chris Antonides, the coach there, helped set it up. And it was one of the biggest thrills of the weekend was watching Jonathan on that mound. He pitched one inning. Ryan, he smiled. He had a smile on his face through every single pitch. It meant everything to him, and it meant everything to me to see that. And there were guys that came back that, you know, it was just a great, great weekend for me. It really was. And I think they all had a blast too, bringing a major, former major league. He could still throw it pretty good, by the way.
Thanks for your time, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. And we'll look forward to being in touch in the future.
Congrats again to Coach Page on his induction into the ABCA Hall of Fame. You can see why his team's had success with the standard that he holds himself to every day. We need that now more than ever in today's society. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, and Matt West in the ABCA office for all their help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter and TikTok, @CoachB_ABCA, Instagram, RyanBrownlee17, or direct message me via the MyABCA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you. I'm doing